Yeah. Meow. Meow.
Meow.
Uh-huh.
Meow.
Do it.
Trigger warning. Trigger warning. This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting live from the back alleys of Babylon. We babysit the binary blip inside your brain with a combination of badinage and technological tabulations, helping to sacralize your senses to the salacious songs of liberty. What is up, Michael?
Hey, this is covered by the BIP Got No Government License. This allows use and reuse with credit by anyone except governments or government agencies. Learn more at bipcot.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Cot, Charlie, Orangutan. No, what is it? October, Tango, bipcot.org. What's the O? Oscar. Oscar's the O. Yeah. I have the NATO alpha phonetic alphabet. Is it what's called alpha phonetic? Yeah, alphabet up on my corkboard here. I sort of know it, but I like to be able to do it quicker, so I have it on my corkboard. Because when you here's a tip of news you can use. When you're talking to tech support, if you spell things out like commandingly in that alphabet, you know, when they ask you, wait, what's your name? Can you spell your name? if you do it, you know, in that alphabet, they know you know what you're doing. And they either pass you off to someone who's like the next level up, or they, you know, put you on hold and never come back. No, I don't know. But yeah, it seems to get better.
I think that's
better help. Yes. Okay. So what's up? Well, you haven't been on the show in 7 months. I dragged you out of hibernation I did a libertarian, not kidnapping, but what is it called? I coerced. No, I didn't coerce.
A mild coercion.
A verbal coercion. Oh, come on, dude. Yeah. You know, get out of your shell so you can do some microphone therapy. Because, you know, up there in those Maine winters where the nights are 40 days long. Wait, is that it? No. What's up there?
Cold.
Yeah, it's basically Wyoming with more Bostonians, right?
Yeah, it's, I don't know, man. Winter actually wasn't that bad, you know, I guess by standards.
It really hasn't.
I think it's just because I'm getting
old. Wait, is it over?
Well, we had a warm spell this week. I guess we're having another cold one, but yeah. You know what I think it really is?
We got a foot of snow in 24 hours the other day. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We had a big one like that, too. I think I'm just getting old because I remember when I was a kid how we used to have much bigger winters.
Did you, though? So. Or is, because I've heard that the reason people think that is because they were shorter when they were younger, so the snow came up higher on their body.
I think there's some validity to that, but I can remember my dad telling me when he was a kid they could jump off roofs
of
houses.
Oh, I have a picture, though. I have a picture, though, from Sherman, New York, where my dad lived when he wasn't born there, but, you know, was young there and grew up. And there's a picture. It's an old black and white picture with, do you remember the photos from, like, you know, non-digital cameras, like the really old ones that had, like, serrated edges, you know, kind of wavy edges?
Yeah, they were on tin plates a lot.
Well, this is after tin plates. This is, you know, probably 126 camera format. People are like, what are you talking about, Grandpa? Well, to take pictures before cell phones and before digital cameras, you had to use paper soaked in toxic silver-based chemicals, and it cost a lot of money, and you didn't get the pictures instantly. You had to take them to the drugstore and pay money. You had to buy the film, which cost money. Then you had to take them to the drug, and you didn't really see what you were getting until you developed it. You had to take it to the drugstore and then wait a week, and then you get it back, and then you had to pay for, like, extra prints of the picture and stuff, extra copies.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
That's why those of us that grew up on regular cameras learned how to shoot pictures really well, because I remember I used to shoot a lot of pictures when I was younger, especially at concerts, and you learned how to
do an f-stop
really well. Yeah.
You ever learn what an f-stop was? Yeah. Now everything's automatic, although really pro photographers, even the ones, a few of them still use non-digital, but it's, I mean, the holdouts, like Steve Diet Getty, this guy I did, you know, like a fashion photographer, I did an art DVD of his photos with. It's called Living Through Steve Diet Getty. It's on Amazon. So anyway, he was using medium format cameras, I think they're called, which was like a 4-inch or 2-inch by 2-inch or 4-inch by 4-inch plate. And he was doing that up to like 4 years ago. I mean, he was, you know, like the last holdout, and half the people thought he was crazy and half the people thought, wow, you got to respect that, man. I mean, because it's really expensive and it takes time and you have to develop it and et cetera for color. But it was like before digital cameras caught up and now look better than film, literally. You know, up until about 4 years ago, I mean, that was the best format there was, and you could take a slide from one of those and, like, blow it up to a billboard size, and it wouldn't look bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I still know a couple of people that swear by film.
Yeah. He went digital, though.
Yeah. If you've seen some of the new cameras, I have a friend who teaches multimedia at college, video, photography, yeah. And, you know, more of the Adobe programs to edit and stuff. But, yeah, he swears by it. He said, you know, don't go out and spend $200 if you're going to be a serious photographer. You know,
yeah.
You got to spend a grand.
But for $1,500 for a camera and, you know, maybe $1,000 more for a lens package, I mean, you can get, you know, for like $2,500, you can get a SLR camera that looks, or non, is it non-SLR or SLR?
Which is, no, it's SLR.
SLR, yeah. Camera that, I knew that. I just remember.
You were just testing me.
Yeah, I was just testing you. That looks, that not only, you know, shoots better stills than a, you know, medium or large, medium? Is it medium? God, it's been so long. It's medium format camera, I think. But they can also shoot video and like look almost as good as like stuff on Netflix, you know?
Yeah.
Stunning. I mean, that's what documentaries are made with now. And like there's a thing called a red camera, which is like that, but it's $50,000, which
is stunning. Well, it's a format.
It's a format. Yeah. Yeah, it's the red, but the red cameras start at like 40,000 plus lenses.
Yeah. Yeah, the school my friend teaches at, that's what they have. Their gear is, and you know, they can't take it out on the school unless they have ridiculous amount of authorizations and plans and safety packages.
Well, you can rent them, too. Is. You know, like in I recently updated my book, $30 Film School, and you're like, why are you writing books as an expert when you can't remember? I just woke up. I can remember. I looked it up. It's medium format. Large format film, kind of doesn't really exist anymore, but it kind of does. Like Ansel Adams used large format film, but I mean it's like the image, the negative is 4 by 5 inches or larger. Medium format is smaller than 4 by 5 inches, but bigger than 35mm film, which is 35mm.
Well, it's amazing how
the
platforms and distribution of media drive the technology. You know, I mean, and so much of the media we consume is on, I won't say low resolution, but smaller resolution portable devices that, you know, that higher end stuff. That's why it's so expensive.
Well,
because most people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but people think it doesn't make a difference, but it does make a difference. I mean, if you shoot something to look stunning on 4K monitors, it's still going to look better on an iPhone than if you shoot it on like DVD res, you know?
Right.
SD.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, just building my arcade cab, I was messing around with resolutions a lot because now the thing is to have 4K, which I'm not going to do, particularly when you're playing old 80s video games.
Oh, yeah.
You don't need it. I mean, you can see a difference, but usually it's just
worse.
A sharper image.
It might look worse. It's a sharper image of the 8-bit, you know, or the Pong.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's... Yeah. Technology is an amazing thing. I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword.
It is, but I mean, I'm all for it. I'm, you know, I mean, I remember when digital recording of audio came out, and I kind of got to see the whole thing of it. Like when the first record I made when I was 20, I think, in 1984, which we put out, we pressed onto, you know, 7-inch vinyl and EP. Extended play. It was like a 5-song, 7-inch vinyl that played at 33, I think.
RPMs.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I did like construction work and like paid drug studies where I was a guinea pig at a hospital to raise the money to do that, you know, like to do the recording and to do, you know, the pressing of it. And now I can record better quality at home. I mean, the stuff I'm recording now with Phil is better audio quality than the record that we spent $35,000 on Warner Brothers having Bill Laswell produce. And he's like world-class famous. I mean, he's done Motorhead, The Ramones.
Yeah. You know what really shocked me?
What?
I watched a documentary the other night on the... It was basically the recording of the album Josephine by Magnolia Electric Company.
Wow.
Who is... it's Jason Molina's band, and anyone out there, if you don't know who Jason Molina is, do yourself a favor and Google him. He's a singer, songwriter, all around musician, and he is just amazing. A lot of his stuff is more
acoustic-y.
Somber.
Yeah.
But he is just amazing. Anyway, I watched this documentary where they were recording that last album, and it was in 2008, and it was in Steve Albini's studio. He was the engineer.
Oh no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh no.
And I actually met Steve Albini last year.
Was it on tape? Was it recorded on tape?
Yeah, and they were doing it all on tape. I was like, wow. I mean, I know it's 2008, but digital audio was well into
I think Steve Albini is the reason that like 3M still makes, you know, 16 track tape, 2-inch tape.
Yeah. He's a real modest guy too. I mean, he was talking about how great, you know, the albums were and stuff, and he's like, I don't have anything to do with it. He's like, I just make sure there's no errors from the performance to the recording. That's it.
Yeah, he's really modest about it, and he also makes some choices that look like integrity that just almost seem insane. Like he on the Nirvana record, he never wants to be listed as producer. You know about that?
No.
He feels like producer is a false credit. Like, you know, the band is really the magic, and he always is listed as engineer or recordist. And, you know, yeah, like he says, basically, I just make sure it's not too hot, not too quiet, and there's no distortion that shouldn't be there. And that's
exactly what he said in the interview. He's like, it's not, if the band didn't make a good album, there's nothing I can do. And if they did, you know, that's just,
yeah.
So, yeah, he was very modest. Really,
you know,
cool guy.
You know, he's in my, he's on the, there's an interview with him on the DVD extras of my 2001 movie, DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist.
I haven't seen the extras. I'll have to check
extras,
that out. The
extras, that's on YouTube. Just search DIY or Die, Steve Albini. It's got like 60,000 views or something.
Nice.
I didn't record it because I was trying to get a hold of him during the making of the film. Like, he had to be in the film, I felt. And he was not available. And then he became available after the film was done, but before the DVD came out, when I was working on the DVD, and I didn't have money to go to Chicago. So I had a friend go do the interview for me and gave her the questions to give him. And then she sent me the tape. Yes, digital DV tape.
The tape.
Mini DV. And it's really cool. It's like, you know, I told her how to film it. Like, you know, said like, whatever you do, make sure there's some light on him. Make sure the microphone's near his face. And it's like, it's recorded in the dressing room of a club where one of his bands, either Rape Man or... Not Big Black. What's after?
Shellac.
Shellac. I think it was Shellac was playing.
Yeah.
And like you can hear the band sort of in the background upstairs, like another band sound checking, the opening band. And it's in this dressing room with like just painted walls and cold and graffiti and like on a, you know, couch that I think is a, you know, the back seat out of an old car. And then they took like, you know, little lights, like old timey, like incandescent bulb, you know, with the little hood on it kind of lights, like just a light you'd read with in the 70s.
Yeah.
And just shined it in his face and then like white balanced it. And it's perfect, man. It put the mic under him. It looks weird, but it's kind of like the Steve Albini video, like how he would probably produce video, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's not fancy, but there's no distortion and you can see everything.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that he was in any bands. I mean, I knew of his, you know, being a recording engineer and stuff because I've always been into that. But I actually saw Shellac last year, and then the band just kind of sat. It was in a tiny club in Portland, Maine, and the band just sat on the stage after hawking T-shirts and stuff. And he sat and talked with a bunch of us. Wicked nice guy.
Yeah, he is.
And the band was amazing.
I don't really love his. I like his music a lot. I like Big Black a lot. And they were a big influence on industrial music, and most people never heard of them. They were kind of the first hard rock band that used a drum machine, as far as I know.
Yeah, I can see that because when I saw them last year, they were this kind of like weird, not dad rock, but kind of progressive, psychedelic, industrial mix.
Big Black reunion?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, it was Shellac.
Oh, yeah. Which is it one person from, I forget, but.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. But I like his music.
Wild.
I don't like his production. You know that Fugazi recorded a record with him and like drove out there and stayed in Chicago for a couple weeks recording it. And then like got in their car, in their two cars, and drove back to DC, and they each had a cassette mix of the whole album. And they said that when they got back to DC, they all looked at each other and laughed and were like, okay, we're never putting this out. We're going to re-record this with Don Z and Tara.
Wow.
Yeah. I got paid $500 by, who's the guy that was the drummer in Nirvana? He's a rock star now.
Yeah, the Foo Fighters guy.
Yeah, yeah, Dave Grohl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, his company paid me $500 to use 12 seconds of my footage of Steve Albini in one of those like Lost Highway series films. You know the ones.
Yep.
It was the Lost Highway. Wait, that was no. What was it? Lost.
No, that was a David Lynch movie.
Okay,
I know it's the. It was like 16 episodes, and they're all about recording.
Yeah,
studios.
Well, it was the Chicago one. The Chicago one. There's like 12 seconds of my interview with Steve Albini. I told them they could use as much as they wanted in $500. They were like, cool, invoice us. And they sent it. It was the easiest money I ever made. And, you know, if you look really tiny in the credits in the end of the Chicago one, it says Michael W. Dean and with like 200 other names, tiny. It's all good. I'm honored. But, I was like, yeah, you can use as much as you want. It's like a 4.5, 5-minute interview, maybe 7 minutes, and they used 12 seconds of it, I think.
Wow, that's quite the payout.
But, you know, it fit the what they needed. You know,
yeah.
So they didn't have to go there and record him again saying it. But I think they actually went there and recorded him, interviewed him too. But so I digress. Anyway, so technology's cool. I'm cool. You've never heard of me, but I'm cool. I've done things. Look it up. Michael W. Dean. And yeah. So it's weird though. Like watching. I mean, the first album we did. So it cost. First album we did at Don Zientaro's studio in Virginia, which is where all the Discord stuff was done. And he's another one of those, like, he's never listed as producer on an album, but he's not, like, adamant about it, like Steve Albini. Like, if you accidentally didn't know that and you put produced by, you know, Don Zientaro, first of all, he'd probably never even notice. And second of all, if he did, he wouldn't, like, get mad at you. Steve Albini would get mad at you probably and say, you need to remedy this on the second pressing, you know, or issue a statement or something. I'm guessing. But he's, you know, Steve Albini, I think his real job is being Steve Albini. Like, I see and read a lot more interviews with him than, you know, I follow his music. I think most people do.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was.
Yeah.
And it is interesting with technology and how media is distributed. You know that I'm a real big fan of Bukowski, and I've been rereading a lot of his stuff lately. And I write, too. And it's just different to see how his poetry and his writing was distributed and how he made a name for himself and how he lived as compared to the modern day. You know, I mean, like, I got a website through Agorist Hosting, and
Agorist Hosting are good. So is Self411, and people should get Self411 because it allows you to avoid calling the government when you need help.
And nobody wants to call the government.
Yeah, it's free for iPhone and Android. Get it at getself411.com. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I just got a website and
Agorist Hosting
stuff up.
Who I also use.
Hosting.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. And, you know, you just kind of throw it up there. And I don't promote my stuff a lot because, to be honest, my art is more for me than, you know, I'm not looking to get famous or anything or recognition. I just kind of put it out there. But, yeah, I mean, can you imagine, like, some of the great writers of the past, had they had that medium? Do you think their writing would have been as good? I don't think so.
It's weird. You know, the thing about digital production and distribution is it vastly increases the amount of crap out there, but it also vastly increases, you know, the rare gems that would never have been able to make an album in the studio system. You know, I mean,
it's just a matter of finding it, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, even with our first record, like, okay, we spent, I think it was like $900 on recording, which seemed like all the money in the world to me. And then we spent $2,000 pressing, or maybe $1,500 pressing 1,000 of them. And we didn't have money for the covers. So we got, you know, we got the little records, 7-inch records, vinyl spinning discs, plastic, in the paper sleeve with the labels on them, but no cover. So we had a friend that worked at Kinko's, and we went in at night when no one was there, and he let us use the printer and cardstock, and we printed covers on cardstock, and then we had a party, and we got a bunch of big Ziploc bags, and we had a party. I said, there's going to be a razor blade party at my house, free beer. That sounds dire.
Yeah.
But the razor blades were to cut the top off the Ziploc bags.
Gotcha.
Just had, well, like, hey, you know, 8 friends come over, and in a couple hours, We folded, you know, the covers together, put the vinyl in them, and then put them in a Ziploc bag and then cut the top off with a Ziploc. And, like, you know, everyone got free beer and they loved it. And everyone got, you know, 2 or 3 free copies of the record. That record's called Pain, Fear, and Insects by Baby Opaque. And yes, you can find used copies on eBay and other places. And you can find them, like, it's weird because all the records I've done that were on vinyl and CD, all the vinyl ones are out of print. And you can find them from time to time used, and they're always either really cheap or really expensive. Like, they're always either, you know, 50 cents plus $1 shipping, or they're like $45 plus, you know.
Yeah, I've noticed that with books on eBay. I've been looking around for books, and it's ridiculous. Like, the other day I scored, you know, 3 mint condition books for $29, but looking, that was like a rare thing. I mean, they were selling the same books for $70, $80, $90,
$100. Yeah. You
know? I just happened to find the one. So, yeah, it's crazy.
You know, it's funny, too, with book prices, like what's worth and what's not. Like, Hubert Selby books, like first editions. So if you can get one that's signed Hubert Selby Jr., it's worth more than one that signed Cubby. Cubby is what he signed his stuff. And if he was your friend and knew you, he'd sign it Cubby. But no one knows that. Most people don't know that. unless they've seen my film, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow. So, you know, they want, they're like, Cubby, who, you know, they think that was some guy who bought the book and gave it to a friend, right, or something. You know, so right, like, you know, the one that really meant something because he gave it to a friend is worth less than the one with his, you know, government name.
Yep.
Yeah. He, you know, I had a real interesting look into talking about distribution back in the day, like in the Bukowski day. First of all, Bukowski had editors. You know, like what you read on the page wasn't the like garbled mess of papers he drunkenly turned into his publisher.
Well, you know? Actually, he did. I mean, I've read a couple and watched a couple of interviews with his main editor and guy that distributed. I can't remember his name right now. He's out in California. But a lot of times they just put his stuff out as is. And he got a lot of
his poetry. I think they put out as is, but his books. Are
yeah,
edited.
His books. Yeah. Yeah, because he need. Yeah, he wasn't a writer. I mean, he said that. He, you know.
Oh, I love his writing.
Yeah,
he wrote Like People novel, Talk, which I like. You know.
Yeah, his last novel, Pulp, was amazing, and it's not very well known.
You know, it's funny though too. His, you know, Bukowski is kind of known for being a starving drunk artist who wrote a lot about like beautiful women, beautiful damaged women he slept with when he was starving, which actually inspired the title. I don't know if you know this, that Bukowski's life and how he portrayed it, or at least what he portrayed it, yeah, is the, you know where I'm going with this, is the inspiration, oh, yeah, for the title of my first novel, Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women. Because when I wrote that, I was literally starving in the company of beautiful women. My drug of choice was heroin back then, before I got clean in 94. But yeah, it wasn't alcohol, you know. And there's a line in that too where the protagonist, Cash Newman, who's based on me, says something like, you know, he's in a bar and he's drinking and he's like buying drinks for everybody and he's bragging about what a great artist he is. And he says, like, you know, everyone thinks all it takes to be an artist is a six pack and a pen, you know, or for rock and roll, some leather pants and a microphone. But it takes more than that to be great. For every great like Bukowski or William S. Burroughs, you know, there's 10,000 junkie drunks dying in the gutter, clutching their pen and a handful of illegible papers, something like that, you know. And there really are. Yeah. I mean, I remember, like,
it's true.
I lived in a neighborhood in San Francisco that was, I lived at Stockton, on Bush and Stockton, like right up from the Stockton Tunnel, if anyone knows San Francisco. And it's a transitional neighborhood. It's between the Tenderloin, which we're going to talk about later probably, which is the, you know, Skid Row. It's between that and Knob Hill, which is like one of the richest parts in the city. It's halfway up the hill, and they call it the Tender Knob. And like every week on my street, there were a couple like hotels there, you know, residency hotels and a couple apartment buildings. Like twice a week, I'd see moving vans on my street, and it was people either moving out or moving down or moving up. You know, like either they couldn't afford that neighborhood anymore and they're moving down to the Tenderloin, or they were, you know, could do better and were moving up Knob Hill probably. But I used to find a couple weird things about that. One is I used to find like, you know, like homeless people who forgot their stuff on the street and walked away and never came back, or something happened to them. And like a lot of times I'd pick it up and find like, you know, notebooks of paper with what looked like poetry or novels written in them that no one would ever see. Another thing that was really weird was one day I got this thing in my mail that was like addressed to a former tenant in my apartment. Oh, by the way, like that apartment, I used to find like, you know, used syringes in human feces walking out my door, literally. That, and it's still like that. And my apartment that I was rent controlled in and paid $560 a month when I moved out of there in 1995. That studio apartment recently sold as a condo for $1.4 million.
Wow.
And it's still that kind of neighborhood. But it was like this old building, like, you know, 100 years old. Like it had like an ice box in it, you know, like an old fridge where you put a block of ice in it. You know, it had a fridge too, but it had that built into the wall. I got this thick envelope one day in my mail, and it was from a publisher. And I was, at the time, I was trying to get published, and I was like, did I say, I don't remember sending these. These are poetry. I don't send out poetry. And it was, I looked at it, and it was to this woman named Alice something. I can't remember her name, who had submitted her poems to a publishing company like 17 years previous. And this was from the guy's wife, and the guy had died, and his wife was like, you know, sorry this took so long to get back to you, but my husband died last year and I've been going through his papers and returning people's poetry. And it was like hand typed, like 25 poems, you know? Yeah. And like, you know, apologies, we can't publish this, we're going out of business, but here, I want you to have this back. And I tried to find her and couldn't find it. And then published it on the internet and then found out later, you know, like, hey, I don't know what this, who this is, but here's the story behind it and here's the poems. And I had to type them out by hand because I didn't have a scanner back in 96 or whatever. And wait, I moved in there in 95 and I moved out of there in 2001 when I moved to LA. But yeah, I was like, you know, this poet deserves to be published. I'm going to publish her. And I'm into helping anybody get anything out there. Like Phil runs this thing called JitProd, which is Joy in Poetry Productions, which is a Maine writers group. And I was like, hey, Phil Warmoth, my buddy from college who I'm doing music with now with Biptunia, you need a website. So I made him a free website. I'm hosting it. You're on there. You did a cool poem on there. I dig it. There's a few Maine poets on there. I'm on there. But, you know, just get it out in the world. And that website gets about 200 hits a day, unique viewers, and, you know, very few comments. But, hey, that's traffic. You know, that's someone looking at it. That adds up.
That's funny. I get, like, maybe 3 views a day on mine. But, hey, whatever. Like I said, I don't really put my stuff out there.
Well, that's one of the things with a collaborative blog, too, is you have the fans and the promotion of everyone on it, you know?
Yeah.
Which brings people in. So it's cool. Yeah.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agrist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agrist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agrist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agristhosting.com.
Yeah, so I was reading the article you sent me.
Wow, you're smart.
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, I know book words and stuff. I was watching Things You Will See If You Tour the Tenderloin.
Oh my
I was
God.
Reading that article you sent me. And I don't know, man, maybe it's just because I'm a Maine boy, but it terrified me. Like, I just can't
it terrified
even
you. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Cash Newman, you know, my alter ego from back in the day, has a Twitter feed now. Have I sent you that? Have you seen that? I got to send it. Can you look at a link while we're talking?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to send you this. And it's a picture from that article.
the black transvestite.
Dude, let me finish the Selby story I started, because I've made a New Year's resolution. I only made one, and it's to finish stories I start on radio, because it's not That's satisfying good. Otherwise, even if you don't remember why, it's not satisfying. So when I was making the movie Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow, you know, which is narrated by Robert Downey Jr., because he was buddies with Selby, and he did that free. I mean, that movie has like Academy Award winners in it. It was, you know, it has Ellen Burstyn in it, has Jared Leto in it. He's never had an Academy Award, but he's a movie star, and has the director of Last Exit to Brooklyn, the director of Requiem for a Dream. And I got all those people in it because, well, Downey, our producer, got him in it and, you know, asked him, like, kind of knew him and said, hey, you know, we're making this movie with, you know, with the widow of Selby's involvement. Do you want to help out? And he's like, yes. And that was like right before his third comeback where he became big and stayed sober. You know, he was like, I don't know, not sober all that long when he did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the resources I got for that was his wife knew someone that had, that was his editor and put me in touch with him, Gil Sorrentino, who died between being interviewed in that film and the film coming out. A lot of people in that film have died in the past 10 years because the author had just died at 75 and I was interviewing all his friends. So, you know, a bunch of people in that film are not around anymore. But some of them got to see it. The guy who took the amazing photo of Selby, like under a bridge with a coffee cup, where he kind of looks homeless, but he's not trying to. He just looks kind of down and out or introspective or sad or something. And he had a really, you know, deep face that had seen a lot. That guy, James Fee, came to the premiere of it at the Egyptian Theater in L.A. Like, when I went over to his house to scan that medium format print picture, I brought a scanner and a lap to his top to his house to do it. He was plump. You know, he was probably 5'10 and 220 pounds, 230 pounds. No, more. you know, like not huge round, but he was fat. When he showed up at the premiere dying of cancer, he was skinny. He weighed like 100 pounds and he was like 5'10". And he was in a wheelchair and someone was pushing him around. But he was really sick. But he wanted to see the premiere because he loved Selby. Everybody loved Selby who knew him. And he had a lot of friends. And he was a great, really amazing person who would like, you know, help anybody. Like the reason he became friends with Henry Rollins, and Henry Rollins ended up being like his son. Like he said, like, yeah, Selby's more my dad than my dad ever was, you know,
yeah.
Was because Selby was in the phone book because he believed you should be, because you should be open to people.
Yeah. Bukowski was like that too.
Yeah. And, you know, Rollins called him up and was like a terrified schoolgirl calling him up because it was his hero. And like, you know, he's like, can I ask you some questions? I have writer's block. And he's like, yeah, come on over. And he's like, what?
Wow.
Now, come on over. Here's my address, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. Total stranger. Yeah. He didn't know who Rollins was. He didn't know his music. He didn't know his poetry. He just knew it was some guy who sounded like he was in emotional pain. And like, oh, right. I can probably, you think I can help you? I don't know if I can. I probably can't, but come on over.
Now that's, you know, really cool.
And they ended up touring Europe together doing poetry, and it like, you know, brought Selby to a lot more, you know, it helped them both a lot.
Prominent.
And emotionally, yeah. And, you know, career-wise.
That was the when Rollins did the Black Coffee Blues, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of tying in with all this, it's weird. Like, when I was younger, like, I've never really been a drug user. I mean, I've done a few psychedelics here and there when I was younger, but I never really did drugs. And one of the reasons was two of the movies I saw that just scared the living daylights out of me. One of them was Less Than Zero with Robert Downey Jr. And the other one
Requiem
for a Dream, based on the book, you know, that Selby wrote. And it just, that one really had a profound impact on me. Like, I remember physically being sick and shaken after watching
that. Yeah, I mean, the first 20 minutes of it look like, wow, this looks fun. And then, when you're getting your arm sawed off in a prison hospital, it's probably not fun, you know, because you're gangrenous. But, and that's the government's fault. Let's put a little political in here, too. You know, it's the government's fault that you end up gangrenous from drugs because they're bought on the black market, which is uncontrolled or unregulated, or not even unregulated, just heroin dealers have no incentive to go to a lab and get their product tested to make sure it's not, you know,
junk.
Their junk isn't junk. Yep. So anyway,
the government are the biggest drug dealers anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you look at where a lot of the heroin's coming from. So, I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah. You see those pictures. Google this if you don't believe us. U.S. soldiers guarding poppy fields. Google that.
Right. If they were really concerned about protecting freedoms and health and liberty and all that, they wouldn't be patrolling those fields with machine guns. They'd be burning them with flamethrowers.
Yeah, yeah. Burning them. So. And getting everyone high in Afghanistan. But yeah, so the thing that I got all of... or a lot of Selby's correspondence with Gil Sorrentino, typewritten pages, like, you know, a stack of pages 3 inches high of letters, of photocopies of letters. I had to pay for the photocopies, but, you know, someone sent this to me when I requested it, and it was like with permission of Selby's wife. And it was, so they'd known each other when they were like 18, but they didn't like each other then because Sorrentino was not a junkie and Selby was a junkie, and he kind of knew Selby and kind of hung out with him, but he was like, you know, then he got into dope and he had a whole different group of friends, and, you know, they're always whispering in this secret language and it seems interesting, but you find out all of the secret language is about getting more drugs. And he said, this is one of the most profound things I ever heard. He said, there's nothing more boring in the world than a heroin addict.
I can see that.
That's very profound, man. You know, I mean, it looks sexy when you see that doctored photo, pre-Photoshop photo in Rolling Stone magazine of Keith Richards when he was young and sexy in a smoking a cigarette with mirrored sunglasses, aviator glasses on in an airport, leaning up against a sign that says, patience, please, a drug-free America comes first. Which I think was actually like put in that picture, but maybe not.
Probably.
I remember that. I was like, man, I want to be that guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, really, like, a more accurate picture is the picture I just sent, or, you know, the after picture, if you're not a multi, almost billionaire. The picture I just sent you, did you see Cash Newman's Twitter header?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's that picture of, it's a homeless, I think, woman, someone in a skirt, lying on the ground, surrounded by garbage.
And a carcass.
And a carcass of, like, maybe a pig, or a human, like something, a rib cage with all the meat picked off it, but still red, sitting in front of her, man. Like, you know, did she steal that out of a dumpster of a meat market? I mean, the Tenderloin is called the Tenderloin for two reasons. One, it used to be the meatpacking district, you know, named after Tenderloin steak. But the thing I heard was that, you know, 100 years ago, the standard bribe to run a criminal operation in that neighborhood was to give the police once a week a large Tenderloin steak package.
I think there's probably a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
You know, dealing with those darn authoritarians.
So yeah. So the this pile of papers between of typed letters, you know, on a manual typewriter. The last few were on a computer, you know, from the early 90s. But, you know, this is going from like, I don't know, 78 to probably 85 or something, maybe longer. It was incredible. I read every last one of them. And Gil Sorrentino, you know, he knew Selby when Selby was a junkie, but then later when, well, Selby was still a junkie, but when Last Exit to Brooklyn was published in 64, I think. And Billy Graham tried to sue that, Billy Graham tried to call, like, forced a trial, an obscenity trial of that book in 66 in England. The publisher could have settled out of court for a little bit of money, but spent a lot of money fighting it and won to set a precedent.
Good.
For free speech in England, which, you know, you can publish things that look smutty there now, but you can't like say the government's not good or they'll throw you in jail. But anyway, So Billy Graham is square, and I don't care how many hospitals he built with, you know, the Social Security checks he talked out of grandma on a limited income. He's not a good guy. But so these letters were amazing, and there were typos in them that were like, you know, he'd go back and like, oh, I hit a typo. Like, just go back and like put XXXXXXX over it and then correctly type it. you know, which is how you did it on a manual typewriter, unless you wanted to use liquid paper, which might not have existed when they started this. Or, you know, there's some electric typewriters had like a whiteout cartridge, like you'd pull the cartridge out and put it back in.
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, so one of the things in this letter, so it was like it started when Selby moved from Brooklyn to LA, and he was sober. He got sober at 40 and stayed sober to 75 and died at 75, which is a pretty good age to live for someone who's had one lung removed and had a lot of problems. You know, it's weird because I met him and interviewed him, and in the interview in the movie I did with him at his house, he's on oxygen, you know, like it's, and you can hear it go like, psh, psh, you know, it's the pulse oxygen like every 5 or 6 seconds. And now I'm on oxygen. It's weird. Wow. Things go, you know, like, did I just want to be like my hero Selby? So I got, you know, kept smoking and got lung damage. I doubt it. I just kept smoking. But it is weird that, you know, he was on oxygen when I was seeing that, when I was interviewing him. I was like, man, like, it's kind of freaky to see people on oxygen. Like, oh, man.
It is.
Like they look like they're dying, even if they're pretty healthy otherwise than that. It just makes you look like. But he was dying. He died 3 months after that interview, and he didn't tell anyone he was as sick as he was. And he did a 35-minute interview, and he's like, I have to stop. This is it. Sorry. Thank you. You know, I need to go lie down. Which I understand now, because, you know, I do oxygen now, and I'm kind of like, you know, a two-hour show. I kind of need to go. Let me take my oxygen while we're talking here. So the main thing, though, interesting in that was, like, he and Gil Sorrentino were perfect together. Oh, my oxygen's like 95. I'm kicking butt. Good. Yeah, last year talking a lot would put my oxygen down below 90. 90 is like minimum good. But now talking a lot, unless I'm sick, like with the flu, brings it up. So the one thing, the payoff in all this I want to talk about was one of Selby's books, it was either The Room or The Demon, were published by Penthouse Press. Did you know they published literature for a while?
Yeah, actually, I did.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Did you know that they published a Selby book?
I didn't.
So Sorrentino, as an editor for Selby, I mean, they were like, you know, Selby considered him like the way, you know, Led Zeppelin considered their engineer or something. I mean, they loved working together. And, right, you know, Sorrentino got him. And, like, Selby did some weird things. Like, he didn't use quote marks. He used a slash instead of an apostrophe because on a manual typewriter it was easier. And he just kept doing it up to being on a computer. He didn't say who's talking. He'd maybe say it the first time. But then, like, the characters were so strong, you could tell who's talking. And the publisher, the editor at Penthouse Press wanted him to change that. I mean, can you imagine the audacity? And the publisher was like 24. He was just out of, you know, J school or whatever. public, you know, general,
yeah, was
journalism
this when
school.
Selby was established?
Yes. That wow. Last Exit of Brooklyn was his first book, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list. It was a huge novel. I mean, it was hugely famous. And then he wrote, you know, a couple more novels, and then he got on Penthouse Press, and he thought it'd be a step up. And there was this kid telling him, that's not how I learned it, Sarah Lawrence, or where Sarah Lawrence, wherever he went, you know. And you know, some boy, some child, basically telling Selby the Great, like Selby's techniques were taught in colleges, but not the college this kid went to, you know. And and the thing is, like, if you're going to invent something like that, you have to be consistent with it and do it for a reason. And Selby was, and he did. But he was almost pulling out his hair dealing with this editor. I mean, he had to, like, he didn't have time to write or edit correctly because he was arguing with the editor about basic things that Gil Sorrentino figured out were good in 1964.
Yeah, that's, yeah, you don't need that hassle when you're trying to create, for
yep.
sure.
So, yeah, that's one interesting thing inside baseball I have about how things were done back then and probably still done now. But see, here's the problem now is, like, anybody can self-publish on the web or on paper or on, I do it on Kindle a lot now too. Yeah. And it's free to do everything now. Like, it's free to publish a book on Kindle. My first novel, I spent $4,000 to press 3,000 copies of them at a press, a printer. I went to a printer, and, you know, now it's free, and even the ISBN number is free with Kindle and with Amazon on-demand publishing. And the on-demand
really?
Books look pretty darn book. Good. Yeah. There's news you can use.
I'm going to have to follow
other
up
news
on that
you can
sure.
use is in June or July, in July 2018, Google is going to start marking all non-HTTPS websites as insecure on Chrome and other searches.
Yep.
So you might want to, people with websites, you might want to get an SSL search.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of surprising that people haven't yet.
But. Well, there's free places to do it now, too. It used to cost over $100, and it still does some places. But,
yeah,
God, what's the company that's free? So anyway, so the problem is now, I mean, the fact that anyone can publish, you do get a lot of gems, but boy, do you get a lot of horse crap. Like, even more than with music, because there's less startup cost in writing than in music. You know, for music, to make music and record music, you need some free software, a computer, and a... a MIDI keyboard controller, which you can get for as little as $40. For writing, you only need the computer and the free software. You don't need the MIDI controller. Yeah. You know, and people think music's a lot more expensive than that. I mean, I'm making amazing music with a $150 keyboard and a $90 microphone. You know, and a $150 converter for the microphone. But I'm making stuff that sounds better. You know, what's the total of that? 300 something? I'm making stuff that sounds, the audio quality is better than the album we spent $35,000 for Laswell and 6 points on the record. He was getting 6% of the retail sale on every copy sold. He made money on the record. I didn't.
Well, I one of the other cool things too, when you, what? Not so much writing, but doing music, when you do it yourself, you know, with a computer and some gear, you've invested yourself and you actually learn a lot of the technical nuances. I mean, that's, I'm by no standard a musician. I've done a few songs on the computer, but I've learned a lot, like how to track and how to EQ and the different frequencies and all that stuff.
Yep. So yeah, we were just talking about no call lists and, getting on the no-call list and getting on the no-send snail mail list. And it kind of works. Most people respect it. Some don't. You can always contact a Better Business Bureau about people that don't. Like, if you get on the list and, you know, actually what I would do is get on the list. And if you're still getting catalogs in a couple months, because it takes a while for them to go through their cycle of the next database update. Then I would write the people directly and say, please take me off this list. And use these words specifically. Take me off all your lists forever for myself and everyone at my address, please. Yeah. Because if you just say, take me off your list with snail mail or especially with telemarketers, a lot of telemarketer companies will do 50 lists, you know, in a year, different companies. If you say, take me off this list, they'll just take you off the one they called about that day. So you have to you have to specifically say, please take me off all your lists forever. Thank you. And I did that the other day, and this lady was like, hey, don't get snippy with me, sir. And I'm like, I'm not mad at you. And I wasn't even really sounding mad. I was just cranky and in a hurry. But I tried to be polite and firm with these things. And I was like, don't get snippy with me, sir. And I said, like, I'm not mad at you, and I'm sorry you have to do this job. And I hung up.
Yeah. Well, emails are the same thing. In fact, I recently had to deal with a
Cell411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell411 has decentralized ride-sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
A government bureau.
Ew.
Yeah, it was kind of horrible.
Yeah.
And I needed some contact information to get some information from them. So I gave them my email address, and I mistakenly gave them the one I used for my main, good email. And over the last 2 months, I have been swamped with unbelievable amounts of spam that there's no way that my browser history or any of that, my email or correspondence would indicate that. And I know
you need to go. You need to move over to Gmail. You don't have Gmail. And I know Gmail, like it's a trade off.
I have Gmail.
Oh, but the one you gave them, did you give them the Gmail or the other one?
No, I gave him my good one.
Yeah, well, you need to get another Gmail and use that for your good one, and then forward your other one into the new one. And then the way to, because, and I know that, you know, Gmail has machines read all your emails and then serves you ads based on it. Yeah, that's annoying and it's horrible, but it's, you know, the government's reading all your emails anyway, unless they're encrypted, which some of mine are. Some of mine are when I'm talking about the weather, you know, I like to
just to kind of throw a monkey wrench into it.
Yeah. And I recently encrypted all my drives. Like when you turn on my computer, there's a password prompt before it boots into Windows. It's not the Windows password, which is very bypassable. It's it's a Veracrypt password. And it's, if my computer got stolen, I would not change any of my passwords anywhere. I would have no need to. Basically, if you steal my computer, you're stealing a brick. I mean, you could format the hard drive and put a new operating system on it, but all my information would never be accessible. So
yeah, Veracrypt is good.
Yep,
for sure.
Yep.
Well, you got to do what you can do to fight all those authoritarians.
Yep, and I use VPN sometimes.
VPNs are good.
Yeah, I like VPNs. We have one to recommend. It's Bola VPN. And they are one of our advertisers, Bola, BOLEHVPN.net. There's you can tell them the Freedom Fiend sent you, or you can use the affiliate link on the Freedom Fiend site. I recently made all of my sites HTTPS. It's worth doing. They look a lot cooler. Like it has this, seeing the green lock too, has like the psychological effect of like, I trust this site. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm secure. Yeah. I was fortunate because Agoras Hosting does that anyway, so I didn't even have to worry about
what's
that.
What's your website? Let's give it out.
PoeticExorcisms.com.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to put that into Google to autocorrect it. So did we finish everything up with the do not call list?
Do not call.
I don't want to miss anything. So. All right. So you want to talk about oppositional defiant disorder or ODD, ODD. I sent you an article. What did it say?
It's an article from madinamerica.com.
Oh, real quick. I didn't finish something. I'm sorry to interrupt. You should use Gmail because their spam filter is amazing because everyone's on Gmail. So they have the, this is spam, you know, click here if this is spam reports from millions of people, which is like cloud, you know, crowdsourcing, knowing what's like within an hour of someone starting to send out spam, like Gmail will make sure no one gets it. You know,
that's for sure.
And
they're
great. They're great about it. Like you, you know, with other spam filters, like I used to pay $100 a year for spam arrest, which is hard to configure. And, you know, like probably three or four a week false negative, you know, like I would get stuff that wasn't spam that would go in the spam folder and vice versa. With Gmail, that happens maybe once a month, maybe I get a spam, and maybe once a month, you know, something from somebody I know. And usually it goes into the spam, and I check the spam, but usually it's someone that, like, I haven't talked to in years and years and years, and they emailed me, like, 15 years ago, Actually, no, because I change my Gmail address every 5 years, too. And the thing to do when you change address, here's the thing I do, is so you change your whatever your email program is, whether it's a desktop program or a web-based program, you change it to your new address, and you put your old address forwarding to your new address, and then you put a SIG line in your new address that says, hey, I'm getting rid of this old address. Please only use my new address. The old address will start bouncing in a few months. You know, you won't, it won't get to me. And then,
That's a good idea.
And then have your mail to, like when they hit return, make sure you change that to go to your new address. A lot of people forget that step.
Deal.
All right, news you can use. So get another Gmail address. Oh, another quick news you can use. If you buy cryptocurrencies and you do it on a exchange, which I can't do because I'm in Wyoming, because the, you know, the legislators are square here and they want to protect me from, you know, engaging in free commerce, even though they say they're small government Republicans. There's three states, Hawaii, Wyoming, and New York. And New York, some exchanges actually do business with, because there's so many people there, they can pay a compliance officer to deal with all the hoops. But in Wyoming, there's like seven people using crypto, so it's not, I'm exaggerating, it's probably 700, and that's probably not an exaggeration, it's that low, so it's not worth having a, you know, a full-time employee to deal with the laws. So there are, oh, but the law here too is that if you run it to do cryptocurrency to operate in this state, you have to keep on hand a cash value equal to the amount of crypto that you're sending, that you're dealing with in this state. That's insane.
That is,
that's just, you know, that's just clipping the wings of the free market. So if you're using an exchange, I highly recommend three things. One is get a dedicated computer for it. You know, buy a new cheap laptop if you use Windows or Mac. Mac, that's you.
Yeah. Hey, I got both.
Or if you're smart like Chandler and I and use all three, use Linux. You know, I, for crypto, well, I don't have crypto because I lost it in a boating accident. Or was it a voting accident? But so if you're going to use crypto, a way to do it really easily and cheaply, you know, a lot of people get these, like, you know, $200 secure wallets. There's a lot of scams going on in that. Like, even ones sold on Amazon, you know, have spyware that sends your crypto to another address and steals your money. So here's how to do it securely. You get a cheap laptop, like a Windows laptop on eBay for $75. Wipe the hard drive with Derek's Boot and Nuke, D-Band, which is free, and then install, you know, a user-friendly, a newbie-friendly Linux version on it, like, Mint Linux,
Mint,
which,
yeah,
graphic user great. Interface has a great one. And then create new wallets, send your money from your old wallets, either on other computers or in your exchanges where you should never keep crypto very long, to your new wallets, back up the keys, encrypt the backed up keys on another drive, keep it offline. The other thing is, yeah, keep that computer offline. Don't put other things on it. And if you and use a new Gmail address, like a new email address for it that no one knows exists, because the way a lot of people are getting hacked now is social engineering, where they get your Gmail address, they figure out how to get into that, then they call up your phone company because they know, because you have your email address and your phone number on Facebook, which is ridiculous, and then they, you know, convince the phone company that you lost your phone and port it to a new phone, and then they're in, man. So if they don't know your email address and they don't know your phone number, you have dedicated ones for crypto, they'll never know. I'm losing my voice, so you talk. Wow, you talk, man. Worms.
All right, worms. Yeah, so you sent me an article that kind of hit close to home, and it's on maddenamerica.com, and it's an article by Bruce Levine. He's a PhD. But he's not a fancy schmancy anti or an authoritarian. He actually talks about the need. I'm not going to read the whole article, but he talks about the need for the mental health system, particularly psychiatry, to maybe take a look at themselves. So many people are labeled anti-authoritarian or oppositional defiant disorder. The new DSM-5, it's ridiculous. I mean, grief is considered a disorder now in the DSM-5. Grief. So,
well, they want everyone in the mental health system to create more jobs for the people, the psychiatrists who write that book, and all their friends, but yeah. Also getting everyone in the mental health system allows an incredible amount of control on people. I mean, if you're labeled as needing mental health services, you have less privacy.
Less rights.
It's easier. It's easier to search your house. It's easier to search your computer legally, et cetera. Yeah.
And one of the points he makes about the mental health profession, psychiatry in general, is that a lot of the reasons that psychiatrists label these people as anti-authoritarian or oppositional defined is because they themselves have that, shall we say, veneer of authoritarianism
in
their personalities. Yeah. It's a very elitist crowd. And mental health has long been used as a tool by the state to kind of trample on people's rights.
Well, you know that talk therapy was invented in the Soviet Union. Talk therapy is valid. It has uses, but modern talk therapy was invented by state psychiatrists in the Soviet Union to get people to snitch on themselves and each other.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and it was Stalin was particularly notorious for, if you were a political dissident, all he had to do was label you mentally defective and throw you in the asylum, which was usually the gulags. But it's a good article to read, and I would suggest looking it up. And he also has some videos on YouTube. It's also Madden America is the YouTube channel. But I think there's an issue that people don't want to address, and that's that when you label somebody as an anti-authoritarian or oppositional defiant, I mean, even depressed, or there's a lot of diagnoses that psychiatrists and even psychologists use that they use to prescribe medication because the pharmaceutical company is deep in bed with this industry. But taking a pill doesn't address root causes, okay?
Right, right.
Like, as somebody who's I've worked in the field for 20 years, and I have friends and family, and even myself, I have dealt with depression.
Don't say that online. No, you were just in a bad mood. You're fine now.
Yeah, whatever.
Don't say it online.
Well, I am.
Well, because they're taking rights away because of people, you know, being depressed.
But the thing is, you know, you can take this pill, right? But you're not addressing the underlying cause. And in a lot of situations when you have anxiety or stress or depression, whatever, and even in some more aggressively diagnosed psychoses like schizophrenia, I've seen patients that stopped taking most of their medications and tried alternative therapies and lifestyle changes that have come out of it. And I think that's an important thing, because if you don't direct that energy, like I would get classified as an anti-authoritarian or oppositional defiant disorder, because I question what is perceived as a legitimate authority. A lot of times that's just a title bestowed upon someone, you know, through social constructs. And just because you question it doesn't give you that diagnosis. Now, if I'm going online on Facebook and Twitter and you know, on the internet or the radio and constantly railing and whatever, it's not really a productive outlet for that energy that you seem to have. And I think the trick is to find a productive outlet, whatever it be. Like for me, a lot of times writing is a great outlet.
Yeah. Oh, the microphone. This is my talk therapy, man, too. And like, I tell the world, and I mean, I don't really keep any secrets, but I'm careful what I say, because I mean, people have been institutionalized for quoting song lyrics when they're totally not depressed, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, people aren't given the options to choose different alternatives. And I've seen that with the mental health system. You know, it's put them on a pill. And, you know, when I used to take my clients to see a psychiatrist, you know, they'd have to go once a month, and they would spend, and I'm not joking, about 5 minutes in the psychiatrist's office. You know, how you doing? What's going on? Blah, blah. And I can tell you.
And they get medicine, right? They get drugged.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's what you need to talk to the psychiatrist to get your medication. And I can tell you, not all, but many of these psychiatrists, while they're asking these standard routine questions, they're only half there. You know, I've seen clients
because they're on the
legitimate.
The central scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Well, yeah, some of them have taken a few Valium, I think. But
you know, in Requiem for a Dream, that's what happens with the doctor that gives her speed diet pills, remember? She goes in and, like, you know, she's sitting there in the waiting room, like, worried because she's gained weight. And the guy, the nurse comes in, takes her blood pressure. The doctor comes in, asks her, like, 3 questions and writes her a script. Yeah.
And the thing is that for a lot of so-called disorders, you can take these pills and it may provide, you're treating symptoms, right? And it may provide temporary relief. But if you have a lifestyle that induces stress, that induces anxiety, if you're in a toxic relationship or an unhappy job, or you're not comfortable where you're living, you know, there's a power station near you.
Or someone died recently. That's a big one too.
Grief is a really big one. And, you know, if you can take these pills, and you may see after about a month, you may see a little bit of a change and notice, oh, geez, I'm not so sad. I'm not so depressed. I'm not so impulsive, whatever. But you're going to have toxic side effects for one, medications, all of them. And then you go into a spiral where you have to take other medications to counter the side effects of the medications you're originally on. And if you don't change those behavior patterns and you don't change your environment, then those symptoms that caused you to go to the doctor in the first place are going to continually resurface, and it gets progressively worse. And there's been some progress in the field with, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and stuff like that, which is it's 50-50. But I think there are a lot of physicians out there that are starting to realize that you can't just treat everything with a pill.
I gotta say though, I am not completely anti-psychiatry, and I'm definitely not completely anti-psych meds. I think there are people who are candidates for both. I think the problem is that the government has such a heavy lockdown on people being health professionals that there are just not enough to where all the doctor can do is spend 5 minutes with you because he has 100 patients a week, you know?
Well, you see, that is true, Michael, and you see that in my field. I mean, I can remember, and this isn't when I worked in mental health. This is when I was doing more dayhab-based facility stuff with people with Down syndrome and autism and everything. But, you know, it used to be one-to-one. You would work with one client, and you helped them work towards their goals and taught them and everything. And most of these guys and gals get their services through Medicare or Medicaid or, you know, whatever it is, the state funded. And though the business that we work in isn't state controlled or state funded, the payments come from that. So when they start cracking down, you know, you start having two and three and four sometimes clients to one staff person. And I can tell you with absolute certainty, I'm pretty good at what I do. And there's no way that I can do a 4-hour, 8-hour day with three or four people and really have a truly beneficial effect, you know?
You know, that's kind of opening up too, though, because nurse practitioners and other forms of nurses are getting more, I don't know if power is the word, but like, well, there's more of them, more people becoming that. And they're getting more, I guess, respect. I don't really, you know, and they deserve it. But I think a lot of it is just because I don't think the doctors are like, yes, let's respect the nurses. I think it's like, I don't have time for this. So, you know, especially with Obamacare of like getting everyone into healthcare. You know, I didn't really see a doctor until I was 50. It's weird.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
And it wasn't because, I mean, I did. I mean, I've been to, you know, I broke my elbow one time, went to the hospital. I've seen a few doctors. But, yeah, I didn't take care of myself. And it wasn't that Obamacare made it possible, although it helped, I got to say, which is really just, I'm not like, thanks, Obama. It's more like, it's a government solution to a government problem, and I'll take it. Because, you know, if it was kind of ironic to me interesting to me that the year my health collapsed because I'd smoked nonstop for 30 years and never taken care of myself and never been to a doctor, like the year it fell apart was the year they said, you must get cheap health insurance that's, you know, doesn't deny pre-existing conditions or else. And I'm like, okay. Right. I mean, I know people who are like such diehard, like by the book theorist anarchists that they wouldn't do that. They just would have gone and died. And I would have died if I hadn't gotten to a doctor. I mean, I quit smoking. I got on oxygen, did a whole bunch of other things, got on a few medications that helped, like blood pressure medication. Well, anyway, it's a long story. But one of the most valuable things I got out of all that was something a nurse told me in passing, because I was drowning in phlegm. Like I was I had GERD and asthma, and such severe asthma that, it was baffling doctors. They're like, we rarely see this. It's called status asthmaticus. It's asthma that's not treated by normal asthma treatments that work for everybody else. Plus, I had allergies. Plus, I had like allergic reactions to the point where my IgE levels were like 7,000. Like normal, no, they were 3,500, and normal is like 75, and high is 150. And I had sleep apnea that wasn't just central; it was also central sleep apnea, which is caused by the brain. It's not just like, you know, fat throat, which causes CPAP. It's or need CPAP. You need VPAP, which is like CPAP that is life support. Like if you stop breathing, it forces air to make you breathe. And I was having 150 events per hour where I was stopping breathing. That's three a minute. So like basically for years, my oxygen had been really low. And I got to the point where I was like drowning in phlegm, literally. Like the little oxygen I was getting couldn't get through. It's a lot better now. I mean, I need oxygen at night. I need VPAP. I'm on some medication. I can't, you know, walk. If I walk to the back of the Walmart and to the front, I'm really winded and need oxygen. But that's a vast improvement. Last year, I couldn't walk down my stairs. Last year, I could barely walk to the kitchen. Last year, I was coughing so hard, I broke a rib and broke my nose because I passed out coughing. But one of the things that a nurse told me, like, you know, after the doctor prescribed a bunch of tests and things and blah, 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 the nurse said, you know, something that I've seen helps a lot of people is if you lift your bed up at a 5-degree angle, just put a couple bricks under the head of your bed. And I did that, and it vastly improved my health literally overnight.
Well, you see that, like, one of the reasons I've passed up, I guess, promotions, or I've never furthered my education, which my dad and others totally hound on me because I don't make a whole lot of money.
Whatever. But, yeah. You help people, man. You literally help save life. What do you do exactly? Don't say where, but just what do you do? I don't think you've explained that.
Primarily right now, I work with older folks with disabilities, brain injuries and Down syndrome, that sort of thing. And we, you know, each of these guys and gals has goals. I help them work towards these goals, whether it be cooking a meal or, you know, I help them with their adult daily living skills, showering. I take them out into the community, try to get them involved, you know, even if it's just going to the store and buying a cup of coffee. Or, I mean, that's really condensing and simplifying what I do.
Yeah, yeah. But, you probably do a lot of paperwork, too.
It's not as bad as you'd think. It's really more than I'd like, but it's not as bad. But, you know, after 20 years, I've learned how to write in Medicare language because everything you do has to be appropriate to be billable. So you learn how to write things appropriately. You know,
which doesn't mean that they're not legitimately. No. It just means, like, you know, you have to fit the square peg into the square peg.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But one of the things, the reasons I've never gone up is because I, like you said, I enjoy what I do. I help people. It's got a little bit of value and meaning. And, you know, I don't dump on these psychiatrists and psychologists and clinical therapists that see their clients, you know, once a month. I think they have value, but I also have a lot to contribute because I'm down on the floor every day working with these people, and I notice nuances of behavior and habits and
and
everything. So I think there has to be a good balance between that upper level, you know, that kind of what's viewed as the elitist part of the medical field, and the lower level, you know, the ground floor workers. And I just happen to be more comfortable where I am. I couldn't do the upper level. That's not for me.
I have some news you can use for anybody that's dealing with an ongoing condition. The first 10 or so doctor appointments I went with different doctors, like every time I'd get a different doctor, and I did get a lot of new ones because people retire or they'd move. Like Wyoming's kind of like, you know, people come here when they're new or they just live here and they retire, or, you know, it's a big turnover here with doctors. And I also like got on a waiting list for the best pulmonologist in the state. That took like 2 years. But whenever I'd go to a new doctor, my wife would come with me because she remembered things I didn't remember because I was so in it. Yep. And just like, and I couldn't really talk very well, but she would come with me and she remembered things because she saw it from outside of me that I didn't remember.
Oh, that's, I mean, aside from, you know, providing transportation and support, technical logistics and support, that's another reason we actually go into the doctor's office with our clients.
Because you know the people and you see the ticks and the whatever.
We see all that stuff, and they may not even notice it, or like you said, they forget it. And you say, hey, yeah, I've also noticed this. And
well, you also forget it when you're under the pressure of, okay, the new doctor meets with you for a half hour and you have to tell him everything. I actually was typing things up too, like making a list and, you know, a lot of times I'd try to hand that to the doctor and they'd be like, well, okay, I'll look at this in a minute, but let's talk a little first. And they'd talk to me, then they'd look it over. They'd read it pretty quickly, but I could tell they were reading it because they'd have follow-up questions about particular things.
So I'm surprised they didn't appreciate that more, because, you know,
they did.
Good doctors take notes, and if you have all those notes,
you give them the notes. Oh, and they'd put they'd say, "Can I go copy this?" And I'd be like, "Oh, keep it. I brought it for you." You know.
Yeah.
And like every doctor I've had has told me I've been really like very good patient, like proactive in my recovery. You know, is how they put
it. That's good. Yeah. So I guess just overall, I mean. I really think that America, the world, you know, individuals in general, I think first off, I think it's good to not question authority, but how is it Ben used to put it? Ben Stone, the bad Quaker.
Oh, no, it was, I know what you're thinking of. It was Bill Buepert said, don't question authority, question obedience.
Is that question obedience. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. I think that's a very healthy trait. Anything else, you can take it overboard.
I got to say, Ben Stone is a great guy. I love him. And I wanted to say on air that recently I said something. It was in the middle of the night. I was tired and, you know, just riffing. On this show, I said something about, you know, I was reading some thread that some former fiends were chiming in on. And I was like, let's see, Ben Stone, MK Lawrence, like reading names. And I was like, yeah, man, ex-fiends, they're ex for a reason. You know, good luck. Don't let the door hit you on the way out, or something like that. Wasn't those words, but something to that effect. And Ben Stone is not in that group of people I feel that way about. Ben Stone is one of my closest friends. We got into a little tiff because there was he misunderstood that, and I could see how he would. And, you know, I'm sorry if he knows that I didn't mean that now. And I'm sorry if anyone else thought, oh, I don't like Ben anymore. No, I adore Ben, man. He's a wonderful person. I dig him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a good teacher.
Yep. Yep. You should get his book.
Yeah.
Recommend his book. Great. I'll recommend his website, and you can get his book and his, we just did some work on his website, so it's a lot easier to navigate and find the meat, as it were. His website is badquaker.com. That's BADQUAKER.com. Check it out, y'all.
Yeah. Grab a hard copy of the book too. Trust me. It's worth
it. I'm scared of that book.
Yeah. I love that book. It's great.
Get that book. I'm scared of that book.
It must be my oppositional defiant disorder that makes me love that book so much. But yeah, you know, overall, I guess the point I was trying to make is, you know, sometimes, yes, medication is a good thing and it's necessary. I've certainly worked with people that suffer from psychoses that need to be countered, you know, with chemicals. But I don't think that's solely the answer. And I think a lot of people are over-medicated. And speaking from my own personal experience, I think if you take an honest, unbiased, non-judgmental look at your life and your environment, your relationships, you might find little things that you can change that'll make it so that you're not so stressed out during the day. So
diet.
You're not so sad.
Diet, sleep, but, getting out of the house, talking to friends.
Yeah. Well, I don't do that getting out of the house thing. I don't really like humans that much. But
well, that's why I got you on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The diet thing, the sleep, the exercise.
Start a podcast.
Hey, exercise, man.
Yeah, get in touch with the internet. If you can't stand people in person, start a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Works great. I just turned 40. That was one of the big milestones over the last 7 months.
You're a pup.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to be 53 in a couple months here.
It was a big deal. And, you know. The gym and the diet thing, it's kind of been, not that I've had health problems, but it's just been a little more pressing.
Well,
I'm like, well.
A thing that I recommend too with exercise, if you can't do a lot of exercise or you don't want to, you just don't dig it, there's a couple things you can do that really help keep your lymph system flowing, which is extraordinarily important. And this is something that this isn't voodoo health BS. This is like doctor knowledge that wasn't really considered that important until about 10 or 20 years ago. So it wasn't taught if you're older than that. Like you didn't hear this in school, and it's probably not taught in school now either, but it's not really taught that much. So the lymph system, do you know what it does?
I can't. Yeah, it's been a while.
Well,
it's
what it does late. Is it clears out toxins and it fights infection. So basically it's one of your lines of defense, and it's extraordinarily important to keeping you healthy. And it's interesting that there's no pump for it. So there's more lymph fluid in your body than there is blood, volume-wise. But the thing that moves it around the tubes is movement, walking, running, jumping. Well, but really easy. Like if you can't, like even if, like I can't go yet, I'm working up to it. I can't go walk, you know, a lot. So what I do is I have a tilt table and I have mini trampoline with a handlebar on it, so you know you can hold onto the bar. Get a good trampoline. Don't get a crappy one. Spend at least $200. Use the Freedom Fiends Amazon affiliate link. But jumping on that, I mean, between like you know, a healthy person would jump on it between 500 and 3,000 times a day. No, 500 and you know 1,000 times a day would be really good. I jump between 50 and you know probably 300 on it, maybe 500 on the best days. And like do it 50 at a time and then rest and do some oxygen, then do 50 and out, you know, half hour later. But, you know, even if you're healthy enough to do that a bit, doing that really gets your lymph moving. And the tilt table where, you know, you go upside down or inversion boots really helps you too. Now, I wouldn't do any of these alone if you're in really bad health at first.
Yeah.
Because like the tilt table, you could, you know, pass out upside down. The same with inversion boots. And, you know, it's easy to fall and hit your head. Like, we actually went and got, like, the little kid rubber corners to put on tables near the trampoline. So if I fall off it, I'm not going to, you know, split my skull. I'll just get hurt.
Right.
But, yeah, I highly recommend that. If you're sedentary, you die. You know, people that are sick who don't move get sicker and die, and not even that quickly sometimes, and have a really crappy life while they're dying. Like, they're sick all the time. You know, no energy.
I can attest to that personally because, you know, I work with two older gentlemen right now, and one of them doesn't sit still for 2 minutes, and he's fairly healthy, and the other one is very sedentary, just sits in a chair.
Yep.
And you can tell. And even for me, like I've had some back problems and some sciatic problems recently, kind of debilitating. And I'm not a workout gym guy. You know, I try to stay fit and healthy. I try to eat well and everything. But I just go for a walk. And I can tell you that movement, especially like the gym is great or whatever. It's convenient. You know, you get on a treadmill and read a book or whatever. But going outside, and I'm fortunate in Maine, there's plenty of nature around. So I can just go walk in the woods. And that's another thing that's really revitalizing. You got to get out into that, even if it's a what do they call those, the botanical gardens in big cities?
Yeah,
just go take a walk out there.
Yep.
Yeah, but it does I since I've gotten into the habit of doing that and you know kind of pushing myself to, and it's not long, you know, half an hour, whatever, it's made a world of difference. So I would highly recommend that for people.
Yep.
Even if you are healthy, it doesn't hurt to do it. So yeah.
Yep. It's fun. Well, we got to wrap up here pretty soon. You got any closing comments about the health industry or oppositional defiant disorder, which isn't really an illness? It's just, I mean, there is an illness called that that's extreme, but people who are often categorized as that often don't have it and just don't like authority. And you shouldn't like authority. Authority wants to tell you what to do counter to your own best interests for the most part.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. I can tell you, working 20 years in the field, I've run into one person that I think legitimately could hold that diagnosis.
And usually, so people with that diagnosis have some other problem, like basically
drug abuse.
Or
physical abuse.
What's the diagnosis that's like oppositional defiance disorder plus, you know, violence to animals or something like that?
Oh.
What's that called? Because anyway, like there's another thing that's like
a
legitimate scary diagnosis that is oppositional defiant disorder is like almost the same as that without any violence.
Right.
And I'm like, what's the problem? What's the problem if there's no violence and you just you don't want to be told what to do? I mean, I didn't want to be told what to do in kindergarten. I didn't want to be told what to do from earlier than that. My sister tells a story of like she was a teenager and I was in a stroller. And she'd stop to talk to one of her friends, and I was like a toddler, and I would undo these three straps holding me in and start trotting down the sidewalk away from them.
Yeah, it's curiosity. You know, I think you and I were both lucky. We missed that whole school.
Oh, we would have been medicated.
Kids.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We would have been institutionalized for our curiosity.
It would have been all over.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm very thankful that I missed that boat. So.
Yep.
Well, Worms,
this
has been good.
Great doing a good show with you. Yep. And
good talking to all you folks out there.
Yep. Thank you for your service and glad you're talking. I hope we do some more of this soon.
Oh yeah, I'll be back eventually.
Worms.
On a more consistent basis. Worms.
Cool, man. Thanks.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. but they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
And go on the sidebar of the Freedom Fiend site. We now have Amazon links for Amazon US, Amazon UK, and Amazon Canada due to popular demand. Worms.